This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross.
Yo, answer this question. Are you a virgin? Are you a virgin?
Yeah, not since I was 10.
It all makes sense. You're a virgin.
I am. Shut up.
How does that happen?
He's a virgin. Oh, I knew it. That makes so much sense, man. He's a virgin.
You guys are hilarious.
All right. Come on, don't be mean.
That's Romany Malco, Seth Rogen, Paul Rudd, and my guest, Steve Carell, in a scene from The 40-Year-Old Virgin. By the end of the film, the character lost his virginity, and Carell became a star. He now stars in the NBC series The Office, for which he earned a Golden Globe Award. He co-starred in Little Miss Sunshine, starred in Evan Almighty, and next summer will play Maxwell Smart in a movie adaptation of the TV series Get Smart. Carell was a correspondent on The Daily Show from 1999 to 2004. Now he's starring in the new romantic comedy Dan in Real Life. He plays a newspaper columnist who gives advice about parenting. But he's having plenty of problems with his own kids. His wife died 4 years ago, and he's now raising a young daughter as well as two teenage girls who want more independence than he's willing to give them. In this scene, a teenaged boy knocks on the family's door, and Carell opens it.
Yes? Very good column, sir. That last bit about curfew is very apt. And may I also say that yesterday's column on boundary setting was excellent.
Who are you?
I'm Marty Barrasco. Anyway, I would like to especially thank you for last Friday's column. It really helped me understand my parents.
Okay. Well, Marty, what else can I do for you?
I'd like to see your daughter, sir, if I could.
Jane!
Actually, I'm here for Kara.
Nice to meet you, Marty. Come back in 2 years.
Dad!
Steve Carell, welcome to Fresh Air. Did you like the idea of being a leading man in Dan in Real Life, a leading man without also having to be a virgin?
It's all I've ever hoped for in life, is to be a leading man that is also not a virgin.
What did this movie give you a chance to do that you haven't done before?
Dance with Juliette Binoche. I've never done that before. I think tonally it's a bit different than some of the other things I've done. Only in that it's a very plausible character. It's not someone that's much of a stretch in terms of being ridiculous or up against a ridiculous scenario like 40-Year-Old Virgin or the Michael Scott character on The Office. You know, both of those are I try to make them as truthful as I can, but they're also, you know, they're kind of stretching boundaries of reality in a sense. But I think this character was a little bit more, without using the title as a pun, you know, it's a bit more true to life. And at least I was trying to make a character that was in most ways an honest one.
Let's talk about some of the parts that you've played in the past few years. In The Office, you are so great as Michael Scott, who is the manager in this small Scranton-based paper products office. How would you describe Michael?
Michael Scott is someone with an enormous emotional blind spot. He is someone who truly does not understand how others perceive him. And if he did gain any knowledge, his head would explode. He wouldn't be able to assimilate. He wouldn't be able to take in all of that information because certain people exist on a different level, and they are only able to exist because they are in a sense of denial about who they are or how other people view them. And I think that's who he is. But he's not a bad guy. I think he's he's a caring person. He wants what's best, but he doesn't always do the best things in order to achieve what he hopes to achieve.
And as an example of that, let's play a scene from The Office. This is one of my favorite episodes. This is the episode in which Michael outs Oscar, one of the employees, and he just doesn't get it. I mean, he just doesn't get what he's done. So early in, at like the very start of the episode, the human resources guy, Toby, is reprimanding Michael for outing Oscar. So we're going to hear that part, and then we'll hear it when Michael is directly addressing the camera, explaining himself.
No, that is the fun of this place. I call everybody faggy. Why would anyone find that offensive?
Okay, I think Oscar would just like if he's lame or something like that.
That's what faggy means.
No, not really.
Oh.
Apparently you called Oscar faggy.
Yeah.
For, like, the movie Shakespeare in Love more than an action movie.
It wasn't just an action movie. It was Die Hard.
All right, Michael, but Oscar's really gay.
Exactly.
I mean, for real.
Yeah, I know.
No, he's attracted to other men.
Okay, a little too far. Cross the line.
Okay, I am telling you, Oscar is an actual homosexual. Yeah, he told me this morning. And obviously he hopes he can count on your discretion.
I would have never called him that if I knew. You don't call retarded people retards. It's bad taste. You call your friends retards when they're acting retarded. And I consider Oscar a friend.
Steve Carell, when you got that script, did you think like, oh, this is so perfect?
It, you know what? That's one of my favorite lines, that we call talking heads when we're actually addressing the camera. Because that, I think, sums up his character. He's not trying to hurt anyone. He just doesn't understand. And then the rest of that episode proceeds with him trying to be politically correct and trying to gain a relationship with this gay character on a different footing and to acknowledge and show how accepting he is. I felt like was an interesting, it was a well-written script too, because it pointed to, that subject without mocking it and having a character who truly he's not chauvinist. He's not racist. He's not homophobic. He just doesn't get it. And it's a completely separate issue. He doesn't get how to deal with people. It's not that he has any sort of axe grind with any one group.
You know, a lot of people who have worked in offices feel like they've worked with somebody like Michael Scott, but you've never worked in offices. It's just, you know, you're an actor. So who do you draw on for the character? Are there teachers that you had or other people who you knew who were
primarily
as clueless?
Yeah. Uh-huh. It I think for me it stemmed mostly from various teachers that I had growing up, because many many teachers that I've had, especially 5th, 6th, 7th grade, would be people who were trying to be as cool as the students or wanted the students to think that they were cool, but indeed they were not. And the harder they tried, the less cool they would appear to be. And that's basically what Michael is up against. He thinks people think he's cool. He thinks people like him and think he's funny and charming, but he's really none of those things. And incidentally, when you say everyone knows a Michael Scott, I guess the rule of thumb, Ricky Gervais told me this in regards to the character that he played, David Brent, in the BBC version of The Office, is that if you don't know a Michael Scott, then you are Michael Scott.
That's really great.
So better that you actually have a frame of reference for a Michael Scott.
Let me move on to 40-Year-Old Virgin, which you co-wrote. How did the idea get started for the film? Were you in on the very start of it?
Well, I pitched the idea to Judd.
Oh.
We worked together. He was one of the producers on Anchorman, in which I played one of Will Ferrell's less intelligent compadres. And Judd asked me at the end of shooting if I had any ideas for movie sort of things. And I had a meeting with him, and I just pitched this idea. It's something I'd been kicking around for a while. I didn't have a script in place, but the seed of the idea, the notion was, and this is what I pitched to him, was a guy at a poker game with a bunch of other guys that he might not know very well, and all the guys are regaling each other with these tales of conquest and women and. And the conversation turns to him, and it's his time to step up and tell a story. And he has no frame of reference. He can't speak this language that these other guys are speaking. And so he tries unsuccessfully to tell a tale of his own sexual conquest of a woman. And he just fails miserably. And that is when he is essentially outed, that he doesn't know what he's talking about and that he's a virgin. And Judd really liked the idea. And from there, he actually said, as soon as I pitched it to him, he looked at me and he said, I could call Universal right now and we could sell that idea this afternoon. And literally 3 days later, he was working with somebody from Universal. He casually mentioned the idea and they bought it right then and there. They just said, you go and write it and we'll pay for that.
You know, at the very beginning of the film, there's a very funny scene where Seth Rogen is bragging about having spent part of the weekend watching A Woman and a Horse. and of course, you have nothing that could compare to that sexual feat. So you tell the story of how you spent the weekend making egg salad.
Right.
I guess, like, you know, since the premise of the movie when you came up with the idea was about listening to these sexual exploits and having like nothing to say that could measure up to that.
Yeah.
Had you been exposed to a lot of those kind of sexual bragging type of stories when you were in high school?
Oh, sure. When any group of young testosterone-riddled males get together, those stories are kind of inevitable, I think. And I always thought it would be funny if one person just could not keep up. And not only not keep up, but truly put his foot in it. In the movie, the character talks about feeling a woman's breasts, and he explains that they felt like a bag of sand. And clearly, this is not someone who has any experience. And to me, what was funny was not so much the story, but how the other characters were reacting to the story. It's like that there's a scene in which I get chest waxed, and I chose to actually get waxed for the movie because I thought it would be funny. And I thought not so much the fact that I'm being waxed is what's funny, at least to me, but the reaction that and a very natural reaction at that the other guys in the scene will have while I'm being waxed. Because that to me, you can't act. If a buddy of yours is having their chest hair waxed in front of you, you will react a certain way and you'll capture something. And to me, that was the funniest part of the scene. These guys just cringing and laughing their heads off.
Well, let's hear the beginning of the chest waxing scene, and then we'll talk about how you reacted when your chest hair was really waxed. Here it comes.
So, ready?
Yeah.
1, 2, 3.
Oh, you I'm sorry. I'm sorry. That's just your job,
you
huh?
Just stop now?
No. It's okay. Let's do another.
That one little patch looks sexy, though.
Does it look good?
Yeah, it looks really good.
Ooh.
It looks man-tastic.
Ooh. I love how you're trying to be so nice. Oh, it's just your job.
So, oh,
were you prepared?
That was the worst day.
Yeah,
ever.
How much did it really hurt, and were you prepared for it?
It hurt so much. And frankly, all of the women on the crew who had experienced waxing in their lives were each one of them came up to me individually and they said things like, well, aren't you sure you don't want to trim your hair back a little bit? Or would you like to take some Advil? just anything to kind of ease the pain. And of course, I thought, no, I want it to really hurt. It won't play unless it really hurts badly. And the woman who was waxing my chest wasn't, in fact, an actual chest waxer or a professional waxer. She was an actress who listed that as one of her special abilities, which, as we all know, are usually lies. So she was just this side of proficient at it. And if you look closely on one take, you can see the blood.
Oh, I know.
Sort of bubbling to the surface. It really hurt. It hurt. And the hardest part was just continuing with it, because after that first rip, I knew that we had a lot more scene to go. And it didn't dawn on me. You know, I went in that morning, I thought, oh, this will be fun. And they'd set up six cameras because obviously we could only do one take of it. And then as she spread that hot wax on that first strip, I thought, this truly might have been a mistake. This might not end well for anybody. But I'm glad I did it.
What ground rules did you give yourself for, like, how much to curse or how much to scream?
Well, my idea behind it was to scream all sorts of different types of obscenities, from Kelly Clarkson to, you know, to the more generic swearing. But that underneath, as you pointed out, I apologize to her and say, well, I know you're just doing your job. So I figured he's a nice guy, but even nice people pushed to those limits can lash out. And in the face of that kind of pain, can drop that sort of veneer of niceness, which is interesting, too, because I thought, you know, just character-wise, that's what Judd and I wanted to do, that not to draw a picture of just a purely nice, innocent, wonderful, sweet guy. He had problems. He was just a guy. He wasn't like – there's a lot of gray area to a character like that. And rather than kind of paint him as a sort of a stereotype, we wanted him to be a bit more realistic, I guess.
So just getting back to that chest waxing scene one more time, did you end it prematurely because it hurt so much, or was the character supposed to walk out with his chest half done when he does?
The character was supposed to walk out. As soon as she got to the smiley face, or as Paul Rudd deemed it, a man-o-lantern, then at that point was when I was supposed to get up and leave. And believe me, I had plenty. I was done.
So what happened to your real chest hair that was left afterwards? Because, you know, you
leave
in a state where you have some of your hair, you know, it's your half
that was
denuded
just left.
Of hair and half hairy.
Much to my wife's chagrin, it was left as is.
Uh-huh.
And she I wore a T-shirt for months after that. I could not expose my chest to anyone. It was really horrifying looking. And then when it grows back in, that is a mess. That is just ingrown hair festival. It is not anything I would ever recommend that someone do.
Now, at the end of 40-Year-Old Virgin, after you've made love for the first time, Catherine Keener, her character, turns to you and says, "How was it for you?" And you break out into song, singing "The Age of Aquarius," "When the Moon is in the Seventh House," etc. Who's that? Was that your idea?
Well, it's my idea to do a big song and dance number at the end. As I was driving to one of our writing sessions, I heard some song. It wasn't Aquarius. Aquarius, the song itself, was Judd's idea, but I heard some song, and I thought, wouldn't it be fun to? I mean, where else could this movie go at that point? I mean, what I thought, what greater expression of joy and release in a way that everyone would break into a highly charged song and dance. It was extremely silly, but I thought it was fitting. I thought it was as happy an ending to a movie as there could be.
I love the ending.
You know what? I thought it was sweet. And some people were taken off guard by it or didn't understand it. I really thought of it as just the most pure expression of joy that this guy could show at that point.
And had you ever wanted to be in musicals?
Apart from being a sexy leading man, that's all I've ever wanted to do is be in musicals. I did musical comedies growing up. I did Summer Stock, and I was Judd in Oklahoma, and I played Duty in Grease, and I did a bunch of that sort of stuff.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Steve Carell. He's the star of the NBC series The Office, starred in The 40-Year-Old Virgin and Evan Almighty, and co-starred in Little Miss Sunshine and Anchorman. In the new romantic comedy, Dan in Real Life, Carell plays a single father who falls in love with a woman he doesn't realize is his brother's girlfriend. Now, before you started making movies, you were on The Daily Show. And you started, I think, just before Jon Stewart got there. And continued till, was it 2003, 2002?
Right around there. I was there for about 3.5 years.
Well, you were certainly there in part of 2003 because you were there at the start of the invasion.
Yes.
So how did you get on The Daily Show?
Stephen Colbert got me the job. I owe it all to him. We'd worked together at Second City, and then when they were looking for new correspondents, Stephen threw my name in the hat, and they called and they essentially gave me an audition. So I owe him that job.
So what was your audition for The Daily Show?
Well, what they do, instead of a set audition, they send you out on a field piece. And my audition field piece was interviewing a man in Colorado who believed that Walt Disney had a subterranean lair built at Disneyland in which he would kidnap children and make them into mind control slaves. So that was my first Daily Show piece.
Was this a real guy who really believed that?
It was truly, and I almost didn't take the job because of this. Because essentially, The Daily Show back then was a bit meaner than it is today. It would go after extremely eccentric people who, for no fault of their own, believed we're just quirky. We're and some were
mentally ill.
Yeah, I mean, yes. To put a fine point on it, they were. And to go out and to mock these people and to do a story about how crazy they are. This guy was mentally ill, and I felt terrible because really we weren't making any sort of point. We were just mocking the fact that he believed what he believed. And over the next several months, and you know, when John came on, the tone changed dramatically. And I almost didn't take the job. The only way, and I talked to Stephen about this too, and asked him how, because he's a very kind, gentle guy. And I said, how can you do it? You know, how can you rationalize this? Because it's just so mean, and it's like shooting fish in a barrel. It's just these people can't fight back. And what I decided to do was to sort of assume the character of a boob, of an idiot. And the more ridiculous I was in the interviews, the dumber the questions that I asked, the more they would react to that. It sort of took the focus off the subject, and I became the idiot. So the audience was laughing at what an idiot and jerk I was as opposed to the people I was interviewing. And I felt kind of let them off the hook. But otherwise, it was a very hard thing for me to rationalize.
Did the Disney piece make it on the air?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that went on. They wasted nothing. Here's the other side of it, though. There were people that we interviewed who deserved it, who really deserved to be taken to task. You know, Stephen went somewhere down south and had this run-in with skinheads and the neo-Nazi groups. And that's a different thing. I mean, that's going after, you know, people of intolerance or people who deserve it, essentially. That I had no problem with at all. But it was that those innocent, quirky, frankly, unstable people, that was never fun. And it was always a trick to try to turn the joke on myself and away from them.
My guest is Steve Carell, and his new movie is called Dan in Real Life. Where did you grow up?
I grew up in Acton, Massachusetts.
And tell me something about your neighborhood.
We lived in a brown garrison colonial, and my dad was an engineer. My mom was a psychiatric nurse. It was a pretty normal little town. I played with my friends in the neighborhood. We had something called Demolition Derby. We lived sort of at the bottom of a hill, and kids would build essentially soapbox kind of cars, and we would have races, but mostly it was to try to destroy each other's cars on the way down. So that's why we called it Demolition Derby. It was pretty normal. I wouldn't say bucolic Rockwell childhood, but it was a fairly normal upbringing with the youth hockey and the youth baseball and all of those things. I have three older brothers, and I was able to antagonize them as much as I could.
The hockey and the baseball and the demolition derby, and where did the theater come in? Where did acting come in?
That was just that was just for fun. That was always a hobby for me. It's nothing I ever thought would end up being a career. And really through college, it was just something I did on the side and just something that I always enjoyed doing, but I never thought it was a viable career choice.
You thought your career was going to be law, right? You were about to apply to law school?
Yeah, that was the plan. And I think ultimately I was planning on doing that because I thought my parents sent me to a private school the next town over. And I think they were not wealthy people by any means. And I think I felt obligated to pay them back somehow by making something of myself because they had really worked very hard to send me to this great school. And so I sort of started thinking about law and that might be a good fit for me. And it came to filling out the applications, and the essay question asked why I wanted to be an attorney, and I just could not respond to that. I had no idea other than that it sounded good, that it's something that I figured would make them happy. And I talked to them about it, and they were the ones who said I should try acting. They were the ones who said, this is something you've always liked to do. You should try it. You should at least give it a shot because it's something you've always just had fun at. And that's what your life should be. It should just be doing something that you enjoy.
So when you decided that you would do that, that you would pursue acting, what did you see for yourself?
My goal as an actor was to just make a living. That was all. And by 1988 is the last year that I waited tables to supplement my income. And that's when I was able to just start acting exclusively and supporting myself. And that to me was the line that I was able to cross. And that was my line of success. That was it for me. If anything beyond that was icing on the cake.
Were you a good waiter when you were waiting on tables?
I was a terrible waiter. I tried very, very hard, but I didn't. I don't know. I don't think I was that good at it. I would, and I'd have nightmares about waiting tables because I would have nightmares that the entrees would be done and I still haven't served the soup. And literally for years after I stopped waiting tables, I still had these nightmares. It's what waiters call being in the weeds. And when you have too many tables and not enough time to service everybody, and there's a great anxiety because all I wanted to do was make people happy and please them. And when their food's cold or they haven't gotten their salad or there's so many things that can go wrong, and I obsessed about it. I tried very hard, but I wasn't smooth. That didn't work for me.
It's funny, like you wanted to please your audience.
Well, yeah, I think in a sense it's like you don't want to disappoint people too because you realize that they're spending their hard-earned money to come.
Absolutely. They could
And I was brought up, my parents are, you know, depression era kids, and it was of their mindset, well, why go out to dinner all the time? You can eat for so much, you know, less expense at home, and, you know, it's much better at home, and it's an extravagance, that sort of thing. So when I would serve people who were out at dinner, I would really want it to be a good experience and just think about the fact that they are spending their hard-earned money and that I want them to be happy. And when they weren't, I would take it very personally and feel badly about it.
One of your early big breaks was getting into Second City. How did you get there?
I took the workshops there, which is generally the best way in. And you start to learn kind of the formats that they use, and you get to know some of the teachers. And then I just auditioned and started in the touring company and did that for, I think, 6 months or so. And from there, gradually worked my way up the ladder of the resident companies.
Did you have characters that you did?
Yeah, I'd have different types of characters. And that was the best thing about Second City, is that you had an enormous freedom to fail, because every night was a new opportunity and a different audience. And you could try something entirely unique to that night. And if it didn't work, fine. You know, you just try something different the next night. And everyone expected that. Everyone expected you to just try different things and different characters, or throw in different lines here or there. And we improvised every night as well after our set show. And that was a great time to just play and explore. And one of the scenes that I tried at Second City in the improv portion of the show eventually became the poker sequence of 40-Year-Old Virgin. And it was a great place to just try it out and see if people responded to it.
So, you know, you didn't get, like, really famous until you were in your 40s. Do I have that right? I think it's in your 40s.
That's true, yeah.
So what were some of the – what's some of the upside and downside of having success come at what is a pretty late time for an actor?
Boy, upside or downside? Well, certainly I've waited a long time. Well, God, I don't even want to start with that, because that – you know what? If I say that I've waited for a long time, it's implying that I always thought this would happen, and I never thought this would happen in a million years. I am so shocked that any of this took place that I pinch myself all the time. And it seems ridiculous, frankly, that any of this actually happened when it did. I think the fact that I'm older is helpful, because I have it in perspective for the most part. I realize that As quickly as it came, it can all go away too, and I'm not assuming that it will continue. So I think I'm enjoying it more, perhaps, at this age than I would if I were younger. Because I think being younger, I would assume that I was just at the beginning, and this is just going to continue to roll, and everything will just proceed accordingly. But I don't believe it. I'm sort of a guy who's always waiting for the other shoe to drop. And so I think that's a defense mechanism to a certain extent.
I remember when you went back to The Daily Show when 40-Year-Old Virgin was about to open. And Jon Stewart was saying, this is a great film. It's so good. And you're going to be a big star after this, because it's going to be a big success. And you look kind of like, what? And he said, you don't believe it, but it's really true.
Well, that's how I feel. It really doesn't register with me. And because I just don't think of myself that way. And I just don't buy it. You know, I've seen enough at this point to know that, you know, people can say you're great. People can say that you are terrible. But the reality is somewhere in between. And I can live with that. That's fine with me, because I think that's the truth. But in terms of all of the success, I'm happy that I had it. I'm trying to enjoy it as much as I can, but I'm not deluding myself into thinking that it will just continue this way. I don't think it will. But that's okay. I'm not fearful of that. I think I'm just trying to be realistic about it.
One of the next things you're going to be in is Get Smart, a movie adaptation of the TV show about a spy, like a bumbling bumbling spy.
Uh-huh.
It's like the comedic version of James Bond. Did you grow up with the show? It seems like you'd be a little too young for that.
I was a little on the young side, but I did see it. I did. I don't know if I understood all the references at the time, but I did see it, and I liked it. I thought it was a very funny, smart show.
What are the TV shows that had the biggest impact on you when you were growing up?
Boy.
And the movies?
Movies are probably easier for me to point to. I like things like Dr. Strangelove. I liked I liked a lot of Billy Wilder stuff.
Now, where were you seeing older movies on television?
Yeah, on TV we'd watch them. And I always loved Peter Sellers. I just almost he could really do no wrong in my eyes. He's one of those guys that could do a character that was extremely broad, but never indicate that he thought it was funny. That there was always a sense that he was, like as Clouseau, for example, he could do some of the most broad physical comedy, and you never got the sense that Clouseau was aware that he was doing anything that was ridiculous or funny. And I think to me that is the key to at least what makes me laugh. When people have no self-awareness that way and aren't winking at the camera.
Dan in Real Life is about to open. What do you do on the opening night of one of your films?
We will go to the premiere and I will watch and probably sweat my way through it because I hope that people will enjoy it. And then after all of the revelry, my wife and I will go get a cheeseburger and fries and a shake and go home.
Is the cheeseburger part of a ritual?
The cheeseburger is. We always, anytime we go to any of these, essentially anytime she has to put on a gown and I have to put on a tux, we will end up the night eating a cheeseburger at this place called In-N-Out in California.
In the evening gown and tux?
Yes.
And are you? It's just, you're the only people there dressed like that, probably.
Well, we drive through and we bring it home.
Oh, okay.
But we're certainly the only people in the drive through. But that's it. Because and honestly, that is the part of the night I look forward to the most. Because I always feel extremely out of place at these things, and I think that might be sort of a cliche, but we truly do. I do not feel like I fit in to that. Walking the red carpet, all of that is just beyond me. I just don't feel a part of that world. I definitely feel like I'm an observer on nights like that. So we both are much more comfortable when we change into our sweatpants and are eating cheeseburgers at 2 in the morning.
It's been great to talk with you. I want to thank you so much for talking with
us.
Oh,
my pleasure.
Steve Carell is starring in the new romantic comedy Dan in Real Life. It opens Friday.